Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. ECOWAS has set 2027 as the new launch date for its regional currency, the ECO. But after previous failed attempts, are West African countries finally at a good place to operate a common legal tender? And if you listened to our episode yesterday, tobacco farmers in Malawi are struggling to transition into farming other crops. We'll hear what the government is doing about it.
We're actually not encouraging farmers to move away from tobacco, but we're encouraging them to diversify. What has been happening is that for a very long time, our farmers have been doing a lot of monocropping. And for your information, the tobacco companies, they also offer their farmers who are under contract inputs for them to grow other crops, especially food crops.
And South Africa is running out of snake antivenom.
This is a crisis. This could be the cause of the fatalities of people having serious snake bites and no access to antivenom, and people will die.
It's Thursday, the 6th of March. First, we go to West Africa. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has for a very long time wanted to introduce a single currency. They say it will help the bloc, which had 15 member countries, trade better and cushion them from the uncertainties of the global economy. The idea for a common currency, called the ECO, has actually been around for about 30 years. Previous attempts to launch it have not been successful, but ECOWAS leaders now say it will finally happen by 2027. This comes against the backdrop of an economic crisis in Ghana and high inflation and a weak currency in Nigeria. Critics worry that these two biggest economies in the bloc will have a big sway on how the currency is implemented. And then there is the political dynamics within ECOWAS, where Burkina Faso, Niger and Mali have stated their intention to exit the regional group. The three are under military rule and in the process to form their own grouping called the Alliance of Sahel States. I spoke to Tilewa Adebajo, an economist and CEO of CFG Advisory in Nigeria. He started by telling me why it has taken so long for the ECO to become a reality.
I think the main reason why it's taking this long to implement is the Francophone countries. The Francophone countries, as you know, for a very long time were tied to France, and their reserves were controlled by the French Central Bank. And that made it difficult for us within the sub-region to be able to reach a consensus without the overbearing influence of the French. Right now, as you know, things have changed significantly within the sub-region, with three or four countries splitting from ECOWAS and asserting their own economic and financial independence. So that has caused some problems or some issues with unity. And then on the second hand, I think you understand that the economies post-COVID has not been very stable across the sub-region. Ghana, as you know, declared bankruptcy and they had to restructure their debts and, you know, made it quite clear that they couldn't pay their debts anymore. So Nigeria has been struggling with stagflation for the last 8 years and trying to stabilize its currency. So while there are a lot of economic uncertainties or a lot of economic issues within all these other countries, people are so engrossed in their own internal economic problems that they're not able to look out to the bigger problem.
The plan is now to launch the currency in 2027. There has been several other times when it's announced that it would be launched and that did not happen. Is it really going to happen in 2027?
Well, even if it happens in 2027, I think the best we can hope for is to have a parallel currency so that you're going to have this currency running side by side with already existing sovereign currencies. I think people are going to probably look at it for a while to see how it works before you look at the process of adoption. So I think even if it's launched, the adoption might take a bit more time. And you also have to consider that we're going towards the African Continental Free Trade Agreement also. That also has an impact to play on this.
So if it's still going to run alongside other currencies of the other countries as well, of the independent countries, what does that mean? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's a good thing, I think, because you need to be able to establish some confidence. So, for instance, if I'm leaving Nigeria now and I'm going to Burkina Faso or Mali to conduct business, so maybe I might decide to get some echoes instead of dollars and take it to Burkina Faso or to Mali or to Ghana or to Gambia and spend it there. So once we begin to establish confidence, especially for the people engaged in trade, that if I take some of my echo and I take it to Gambia, then it's acceptable. Then I think we begin to build confidence in that currency. And the settlement systems, I think, are assured that the central banks have bought into it. And, you know, things could work out for the best. So I think there's a confidence building process. And that's why I think it's important that it needs to run parallel for adoption.
So what are the reasons why the ECOWAS countries would not want to just get into it with both feet?
There are sovereign issues. There are issues of reconciliation. There are issues of losing control of your central banks. Then you're using a joint monetary policy. The problems in Senegal can impact the problem in Togo. And if Ghana has a problem with bankruptcy, then there are issues that tend to go with currency management, which really has to do with your reserves. So there really needs to be reserves that need to go to back up this currency. There are issues with settlement. And of course, there are issues with sovereignty. And as you can see from the European Union, it's not been easy with the euro. And that's why the British, even though they were part of the EU before Brexit, opted to have their own independent currency. And, you know, a few countries also in Europe have still maintained their own currency. So it's not an easy process maintaining a European central bank. So you're going to have a West African central bank. And that is really where the biggest challenge is.
So what problems in the region is this currency going to solve?
The basic problem is going to solve is that of exchange. So instead of buying dollars, then we start buying echoes if you want to trade in the West African subregion. So that's the biggest solution so far. So why do we want to buy dollars? Because I want to do business in Gambia. So if I can buy echoes instead, then I think it gives us a regional settlement system. So I think we should start with the regional payments and settlement systems. You know, the Afriexim Bank already has Africa-wide payment settlement systems as we see it right now. So that is a big leap forward. So if you can incorporate part of the Afriexim payment and settlement system, then what that happens is that we do not need dollars. So because trading within Africa and even within the ECOWAS subregion, we're always buying dollars to buy CFA or using CFA to buy dollars then to go into Naira, you know. So, but some of the people who trade within the subregion are already exchanging local currencies. There's an informal sector whereby you can change your Naira to CFA or from your Naira to CDs and those sort of informal sectors in those markets. But if you have a currency like ECO, then what you do is you replace the dollar. That's really the biggest advantage. And that's a big step forward.
And why have the currencies in the past really been pegged to the dollar? And especially you brought out the CFA there. It's astonishing that you have to buy a dollar first if you're in Nigeria to be able to get your hands on CFA.
Those are the contradictions or the idiosyncrasies within the African economy. And that's one of the things that the African Continental Free Trade Agreement really needs to resolve, that settlement. And that's why this payments and settlement system that the Afriexim Bank has recently developed is very important for settlement. So that if I want to buy something in Kenya, I can put down my Naira and I can get the exchange for shillings. You see, so I don't need to go through a third currency, which is the dollar, or go through the CFA. And, you know, so those are the things that we need to establish. I think that's even more important than, you know, adopting a single currency.
But this is also happening at a time when ECOWAS is not exactly in one piece. Some of the countries have expressed their intention to leave, those in the Sahel. So if this is to happen, give us a scenario of how it would play out if some of the countries want to leave the region. Do they stop using the currency?
Well, what I always believe is when it comes to trade, people have a more realistic approach. And I think the integration type of things that these people who even want to leave, I'm sure that if the business people in that region understand that this is the currency of choice within the region, I'm sure they won't have a choice with adoption, even though their ideology might be different. When it comes to economics, business and money matters, I think that's the bottom line. And they see that this is the accepted currency to trade, because don't forget also these Sahel countries are also landlocked. So they're very dependent on the other countries for their port facilities, for their trading facilities. So I'm sure that their own adoption of the currency, I think, will override the ideology of trying to leave this ECOWAS subregion.
Some of the countries in the region also use the CFA, like we said. Can we draw any lessons there? Or the fact that it's the reserves are in France, then it's probably the wrong example to look at when we are looking at how a common currency for West Africa would work.
Yes, some of those African countries have broken away from the sub-region. And what tends to happen is that they have moved their reserves out. I think some of those Francophone countries have now been independent. And even within West Africa, you already have a Francophone central bank that manages some of those Francophone countries. So in terms of adopting a single currency, the Francophone countries already have the experience. So I think we can borrow from their experience to be able to see how we can manage the ECO, because they have a better understanding. So I think the adoption from their levels will be very high. And I think the rest of the West African countries, sub-region, can learn from that experience.
Tilewa Adebajo, economist and CEO of CFG Advisory. If you were listening to the program yesterday, you probably heard me talking about tobacco farmers in Malawi. I spoke to Maynard Nyirenda, who is the founder and current executive director of the Sustainable Development Initiative, a non-governmental organization working to improve the quality of lives and livelihoods of the people and promote sustainable development. He's also been working with farmers, and he told us that the decline in tobacco demand globally has severely impacted their livelihood, and that they are struggling to make ends meet. Let's listen.
With the demand decreasing for tobacco, the impact has been very, very huge. Some have fallen below the poverty levels that they were, evidenced by them selling their actual assets that they have accumulated for a long time. Most are struggling to meet their basic needs, such as food, a decent shelter, and decent education for their kids. Now, what's making things worse, one would assume that they would migrate to another crop. However, they are still glued to tobacco, and that brings a lot of problems because it brings in a ripple effect.
Maynard Nyirenda is also a researcher for STOP, a tobacco industry watchdog, and the group's report found that smallholder farmers account for 95% of Malawi's tobacco production, and yet they are not getting the help they need to transition successfully into farming other crops, something that the Malawian government denies. We played that clip of Maynard to Sam Dalitso Kawale, the agriculture minister, who insists that the situation on the ground is quite different.
So I cannot say I quite identify because that clip, I don't know the context of the question that it was asked. So it's very difficult for me to say I totally identify or not. But what I can say is, first of all, he talked about the decline in tobacco. I'm not sure if we're on the same page on that one, because my understanding is that on one end, we're having the anti-tobacco movement going around. And then on the other side, we still have countries around the world that still need tobacco to be produced. Now, in our context in Malawi, the demand for tobacco keeps getting high. If we look at what happened last year and this year, the demand for tobacco is even more than the previous years. So in the context of Malawi, I would say that we are not on the same page on that one. On the issue of farmers struggling because of the tobacco market, and having to sell assets to meet basic needs, there are so many factors, but not necessarily because the tobacco market has declined in Malawi. The challenges that a lot of farmers in Malawi have faced over the last 3 years is because of climate change, which has reduced the production of tobacco for them to get the much needed revenue to support and meet the basic needs.
So why are the farmers in the country then saying that the demand is low, that they are not making enough money from it to begin with, and they are struggling and looking actually to transition to other crops?
No, as I said, the factors that we know is not that the demand is low, because the tobacco companies have bought literally everything that the farmers have produced over the past couple of years. And also, if you look at the market price, the farmers the last 3 years, they've actually made more money from tobacco than the other years before. And this
year, how much more?
Last year, the price of tobacco was averaging $4 per kg compared to the previous years where they were selling $2 per kg, $2.50 per kg. But we managed to hit $4 on average per kg last year. So, and this year, we are looking at maintaining or even providing better prices for the farmers.
You say that there's an anti-tobacco movement in your country, but is there a government initiative to actually help farmers move away from tobacco production?
No, we're actually not encouraging farmers to move away from tobacco, but we're encouraging them to diversify. What has been happening is that for a very long time, our farmers have been doing a lot of monocropping. And because of monocropping, the issues of climate change have been hammering them badly.
Who is in charge of this diversification program that you're talking about? Because there is an understanding that the tobacco buying companies have, to some extent, been tasked to help farmers diversify. Is that correct?
Yes, that's very correct. Last year, I was in Machinga District, where we had the tobacco farmers, the Agriculture Research Extension Trust, ARET, and also the Tobacco Commission of Malawi, where we visited farmers in their demonstration fields, where they were actually demonstrating how this diversification is happening. And for your information, the tobacco companies themselves, they also offer their farmers who are under contract inputs for them to grow other crops, especially food crops and other high-value crops for them to use at home, so that the tobacco can continue to be available. So this is happening with us, the Minister of Agriculture, the departments within the Minister of Agriculture, and the tobacco companies themselves. So we are all on the same page on this one.
I don't know if you're on the same page, Minister, because it's the farmers that are saying that that diversification program is not benefiting them. It's leaving them far worse than they are, specifically because some of them have very small pieces of land.
Exactly. Now we are moving towards the real issue of why they are not benefiting from diversification, which is issue of land holding size. You also have to understand that when it comes to tobacco farmers, there are two groups of tobacco farmers. There are those under contract farming and those that are just producing their own to take the tobacco to the auction floors. The ones that are on contract farming, they're being assisted by the companies that they are giving them their contracts. Those that are not on a contract farming, those are the ones that do not have direct assistance from the big companies, but that's where we as the Minister of Agriculture and our departments like ARET and the Tobacco Commission are coming in. But we haven't just left this work of helping the farmers to diversify to the tobacco companies. That's why we have the extension services through ARET going to those farmers. Now, for those farmers who feel that they are not benefiting, one is because they have not accessed the extension services to get the technical information on how to diversify.
Yeah, so on the extension services, those are government services,
yes,
that you should be providing to the farmers. Why are you not doing it?
Yes.
Because some are saying they don't know anything about that.
Yes, that's very true. So for a very long time, we've realized that we are not getting enough funding to go towards extension services. So what we've done, starting from last year and this year, we've actually launched the new extension services, where we are now moving towards digital extension services. Last year, we launched the first 24/7 agriculture radio station in Malawi, which is providing information to our farmers on a daily basis, 24/7. Secondly, we have launched a couple of apps on the phone, some for Android and some on GSM, so that farmers can access extension services for them to know what to do when they're facing different challenges. We understand that we cannot physically have extension workers on the ground because of the salary packages that are associated with that. That's why we are also technologically alert and aware, and we have embraced the use of technology for extension services for us to be addressing these issues of lack of assistance, which the farmers are not having.
Minister, some of the farmers are wondering how it is possible for the government to place that responsibility, or at least part of it, for the diversification on the very tobacco companies that will buy and profit from this crop. How can they do it effectively, basically help farmers have options and potentially move away from the very crop that they expect to buy from them?
Okay, we are all on the same page with the tobacco companies, because all what we want is to increase production, productivity. Actually, the biggest losers, if we don't have good extension services, the biggest losers are the tobacco companies, because what happens is when there is the impact of climate change, most of their farmers, they sell their crops while in the field before harvesting so that they can have quick money. So the vendors, they come and buy from them, and then sometimes they even sell outside the country. They smuggle it outside the country. So for them to protect their crop so that they can get the necessary yield, they are actively involved in providing assistance to diversify.
So, Minister, about 5 years ago, your government actually said that part of the transition and diversification program that would have for tobacco farmers is potentially farming the industrial cannabis. And then this was rolled out. But I've not heard you talk about it so far. Could you tell us what's happened with that?
We have put together a legislation. So we have the cannabis bill. Not only that, the Cannabis Regulated Authority has got bylaws, regulations that we are using. And thirdly, we have registered companies that are helping our farmers to produce, to process, to do value addition of our cannabis.
So is it actually possible for your typical small-scale tobacco farmer in Malawi to diversify or transition into growing cannabis? Because last time I checked, a license to grow this was costing over $1,500, which is a lot of money for most people.
No, we are not targeting smallholder farmers for cannabis. I need to be very honest with you. We are supposed to be very realistic. Growing cannabis, it's an art on its own that requires someone to understand how the plant is supposed to be produced. So if you do this to a smallholder farmer, you are just asking for, that's a recipe for disaster. So what we are doing is for the smallholder farmers.
Some of those farmers were hoping and understood at the time in 2020 when you launched this program that it was for them to benefit. They did not think it was for industrial producers and people with a lot more money than them. Were they misguided into thinking that way?
No, they were not misguided. But what I'm saying is we are supposed to do this in an organized way so that we are also protecting them from producing something that is not going to be marketable. There's a lot of misinformation in terms of the production of cannabis where they think you can just grow anyhow or anywhere or any type. So that's why I'm saying that our focus is we need to move this very slowly for us to help our smallholder farmers understand how to produce this very well.
Minister, thank you for sparing time to speak with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Malawi's Agriculture Minister, Sam Dalitso Kawale. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Some of you love snakes, while others, like me, are scared of them. Here's what the hiss of a black mamba sounds like. That's just terrifying. These black mambas are found in South Africa. They live along the coastal regions of KwaZulu-Natal. You'll hear more about them shortly, but did you know that snakes can be found on every continent except Antarctica? Most snakes are not venomous, of course, but should you come across one that is, then a single snake bite can kill you. Unless, of course, if you are given an anti-venom. But the South African National Health Laboratory Service has stopped manufacturing snake, scorpion, and spider antivenom. It has not said when it will start again, but this leaves millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa at extreme risk. And that's because South Africa exports antivenom to the countries in the region. I've been speaking to Johan Marais of the African Snake Bite Institute to find out more. You know, I actually saw that your Instagram is JM Snakes. I am very scared of snakes myself.
I always say to people I was married before, I'm scared of nothing.
Okay, so let's talk about what's happening in South Africa then. But start by telling us what the South African National Health Laboratory Service actually does.
So they have a variety of services. And one of the services, they have a division called the South African Vaccine Producers. And for more than 60, 70 years, in fact, close to 100 years, we've been producing antivenom. And not just for snakes, spiders, scorpions, and they also involve things like tetanus. So there's a variety of services that they offer. And to some degree, a lot of these services are part of our social responsibility.
So what's happening now that the anti-venom is not being produced by the South African vaccine producers?
This started about three years back. Historically, I'm talking about over the last 10 years, there were various stages where they ran short of anti-venom for a few weeks. But in the last 3 years, it's been an absolute disaster. And veterinarians, for instance, who use a lot of anti-venom for dogs bitten by snakes, have not been able to purchase anti-venom. And even for humans, for hospital use, there has been a severe shortage. And now we've got to a stage where they admit that they have zero stock and no current production. So there's no polyvalent anti-venom. The polyvalent is the one that covers the majority of venomous snakes. There's nothing available, and they're not really producing. And they say that they'll be back on production shortly. They're busy with a revamp. Whether this is true or not, I have no idea.
Is this a crisis?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is a crisis. This could be the cause of the fatalities of people having serious snake bites and no access to anti-venom, and people will die. We already know that over the last 3 years, hundreds and hundreds of pets, especially dogs, have died because vets could not purchase anti-venom.
What is South Africa doing about it in the meantime, because they are not able to produce locally? Are they importing it?
The government's doing nothing, but there has been private initiatives, and there is an anti-venom called Pan-African Premium that is being imported from India. It is a good product. It has a World Health Organization endorsement, and it is now going into both private and government hospitals. The problem with this anti-venom is that it's going to cost double the amount of money per treatment. So already snake bite treatment is very expensive, and now we're looking at that cost doubling because the anti-venom is a lot more expensive.
I'm wondering why there wasn't any preparation if the facilities that are making this were going to be getting revamped and probably stop production for a while. How come this moment wasn't prepared for?
Well, as I say, this has been going on for 3 years. 3 years back, the excuse was that we have power outages. My personal view is just government inefficiency, totally inefficiency and no real planning. And it's tragic because snake bite in Africa is largely a poor man's disease. If you're a poor farmer that is tilling the land to feed your family, you are more exposed to snake bite than any person sitting in a city or in a suburban garden. And a lot of these poor people are far away from the nearest hospitals. In fact, the hospital that treats most of our snake bites, the average time from being bitten to getting to hospital is up to 3 or 4 or 5 hours. So this really is problematic. And no one really considers the socioeconomic impact of snake bite. You know, if a poor farmer loses a hand, he might be feeding 20 people in his village. There's 20 people that don't get food.
And how many of such people are likely to be impacted in South Africa alone if anti-venoms are not available?
Snake bite is a big issue. You know, we have close on 4,000 people bitten every year by snakes. We have probably between 12 and 24 deaths every year. But what we don't look at is the morbidity. We don't look at those people that have a bad snake bite and they end up in hospital for 6 months with 4, 5, 6 operations because of the tissue damage that the venom does. So it really does impact on a lot of people.
Tell us about the anti-venom itself. How does it work? What does it actually do to a patient?
The process of making anti-venom is a prolonged process where we use horses and we hyper-immunize them. So we inject a bit of venom into a horse, we trigger its immune system, next week a bit more, and the process takes about 9 months. Once the horse is immune to the snake venom, blood is extracted every second month. You can take about 9 liters of blood, you remove the serum, you purify that, and that purified serum is the anti-venom. And what it does when a patient is injected with anti-venom is it finds the venom and it neutralizes it. But the problem is you're now bitten on the hand, your arm swells up in an hour or two or three, you have severe tissue damage. That venom in your blood won't easily reach that section of your body where the tissue damage is done. So the anti-venom doesn't reverse tissue damage, and that is problematic because that could take weeks or months and may require surgery. And in some cases, we even see that amputations are necessary.
It's very interesting what you said about horses. I didn't know that's how it's actually made. Why horses?
Well, we use an animal's immune response. And some countries, like in America, they use sheep but their antivenom costs about 20 times more per vial because it's a smaller animal and it's more expensive to maintain. So we prefer horses because they have a very good immune system. They're large animals, they're easy to manage, and you can draw a lot of blood at a time. You can take up to 9 liters at a time.
And where is it being imported from? Which are some of the countries that are supplying to South Africa?
So this only comes from India, and we have a local supplier. It's a good product. It has WHO approval, but we still need to see how effective it's going to be on the various different snake bites. That information we don't have yet.
Talk to us about the role that actually South Africa plays when it comes to supplying antivenom to the rest of the continent.
Well, that's another major issue because, over the years, the South African vaccine producer's product, the polyvalent antivenom, was exported to a variety of countries. So I've done work in Senegal, Guinea, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Angola, Mozambique, and everywhere I go, I used to see the South African product in their fridges. None of those countries now have access to the antivenom because there's no production and no stock at the moment. So this means that every other African country who wants to now import the Indian antivenom have to jump through all those hoops and get all the permissions and the licensing. And the snakes vary. We know what how effective the SAVP antivenom is against other African snakes. With a new product, we don't have that information yet. So that is problematic.
And is it particularly concerning? One would wonder, are we getting into a season where perhaps snake bites are very popular in South Africa? And this is at a time when there is no antivenom, actually.
We are in the middle of the snake bite season right now, as we speak. And then what we see, we're heading for winter. So what we see just before winter, and I'm now talking end of March, early April, we see a peak in snake activity as they start settling down for the cold winter that's coming. And because of this extra activity, we see a spike in snake bites. We've got lots of problems there.
Dan, what steps does the government need to take at this point?
They need to get their act together. They need to, they say they're upgrading the facilities. I certainly hope it's true. They need to increase the quality of the product because with the South African antivenoms, we also have a large percentage of patients having very, very bad reactions to the antivenom. About 4 out of 10 patients go into anaphylactic shock. And anaphylactic shock is life-threatening. And all they need to do is to give us a better product where they can reduce the number of incidences of anaphylaxis. And they need to get the production up. They need to produce enough to supply the demand.
So what does anaphylaxis mean? What you say, the shock that you get if you use the wrong?
Yeah. Anaphylaxis is a severe allergic reaction. What basically happens is the moment you start injecting the antivenom into the patient, their blood pressure drops, the throat region closes up, you battle to breathe, and your heart stops. So you can die within minutes once you go into anaphylaxis. And for this reason, we only treat patients for snake bite in a hospital environment where we have a medical team and they are geared to cope with emergencies like anaphylaxis. So they will have the necessary drugs ready and they know exactly what to do. And the moment a patient goes into anaphylaxis, they have to stop injecting the antivenom immediately and stabilize the patient.
Johan Mare from the African Snake Bite Institute. Focus on Africa was put together by Blessing Aderoba in Lagos. Nyasha Michelle and Sunita Naha were in London. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior producer and Philip Bull, the technical producer. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.